Hello and welcome to a podcast series on media freedom in South Asia, where we look at how COVID-19 has impacted the media industry, how the pandemic was covered in this year in the subcontinent, and what the crisis means for a region that is already grappling with dwindling press freedom. In our last episode, we took a deep dive into mass layoffs in the Indian media sector. This time around, we widen our lens and look at the region as a whole, the region which ranks very low on the press freedom index. India is at rank 142, Pakistan at 145, and Bangladesh at 151. So let me welcome our guests from these three countries. Let's call it a remote roundtable of sorts, virtual roundtable. And all three of us, all three of our guests are from very historic and culturally rich cities, from Dhaka, Bangladesh. We have Badi Usman Bey, senior editorial assistant at the Daily Star. For those of our audiences who are not South Asian, the Daily Star is, I believe, the largest newspaper in Bangladesh, the single largest.
Yeah, in terms of circulation.
In terms of circulation, and certainly one of the biggest ones in the region as well. He has written about the crisis in his own industry, and we're happy to have him with us. From Lahore, Pakistan, we have Heather Kaleem. Heather is somebody who wears multiple hats. He is a journalist, a researcher, and an activist. And he does all of those three things. He has been the central organizer for the Lahore-based Progressive Students Federation and the Progressive Students Collective. Thank you for being with us, Heather. Finally, from my own city and the city where this podcast is being recorded, New Delhi, India, we have someone who's very special, and I must confess, I'm a bit of a fan, Manisha, of your weekly show, Nuisance, in which you hold the media to account. And once again, for our non-Indian and non-South Asian audiences, News Laundry, of which Manisha is the executive editor, is not just a news website, it's also a very effective media watchdog. So effective, in fact, that as a Christmas present, you received a couple of defamation notices, if I'm not mistaken. So some of them are not very happy with some of these legacy media outlets aren't very happy with... The case of media going after media. Legacy media going after what you describe as independent media. So speaking of News Laundry, let me pull up some research that News Laundry did in 2019. This was pre-pandemic, and I'm assuming that this has gotten worse in the year of the pandemic. So News Laundry in 2019 did a content analysis of 202 debates from four major Hindi language news channels, Aaj Tak, News 18, Zee News, and India TV. 79 of these debates were spent attacking Pakistan. And I don't know, Heather, if you relate to that, because we've also heard that it's a similar story in Pakistan. If you say something that's wrong, you know, it's often blamed on India. So a lot of that has been happening in India with the increasing alarmity. So 79 debates were attacking Pakistan, 66 were spent attacking the opposition, and 36 were reserved exclusively for praising the prime minister. Now, there are two things happening here. Number one, there is a search for enemies of India, you know, who are the enemies of the nation and enemies of the state. And number two, a kind of cult of personality is being built around the prime minister. Now, there is certainly a crisis of credibility, and media is turning into hate media. So Manisha, my first question is for you, and it's a two-part question. Since we are in the year of the pandemic, for non-Indian audiences, could you briefly explain how the COVID crisis was covered by the corporate mainstream Indian media, specifically with what happened with the Tablighi Jamaat and with certain news channels very specifically scapegoated minorities? And number two, there's something that you guys say at News Laundry a lot. You say pay to keep the news free, which sounds like an oxymoron. It sounds almost ironic. You know, how is the news free if I'm paying? So if you can explain that and explain why this advertiser-based model, which we all function on, or the corporate media functions on, why is that at the heart of the problem? So these two questions, if you can just sort of delve into first.
So I think that before the pandemic hit us, we've already in India had a very tumultuous time with the CAA protests. You had protests at Shaheen Bagh. You had students' protests happening. And you had the Delhi riots. Right before the pandemic, you had a really brutal, bloody riots at the heart of our national capital. And so there was already a lot of sort of communal dog whistling that was happening in mainstream television media and Delhi-based television media. I'd like to make that distinction. This is mostly what I'm going to be talking about is mostly Delhi-based English and Hindi television media. So there was a lot of communal dog whistling happening. And when the pandemic hit, we were really wondering to ourselves, like, how are they going to turn this into a Hindu-Muslim thing? This is a pandemic that's going to affect everyone, Hindus, Muslims, everyone. You know, like to say, to, you know, use a cliched line, the virus doesn't distinguish between religions and castes and gender.
We were all really wondering together. Like, that was something that we were.
Yeah, exactly. So we were wondering, like, how are they going to twist this into a religious thing? And Tablighi Jamaat dropped in as like the perfect opportunity for everyone to jump into it. So in the early days of pandemic, a lot of what we saw on television media was a celebration of what the prime minister was saying. So I, you know, if he's saying ki ghanti bajao, diye jalao and all that. So you saw a lot of that. When the lockdown was announced, you saw, in fact, it was quite jarring because when the lockdown was announced, there was a, you know, mass of migrant workers who had to go back home, who were stranded. You had really dramatic scenes of people walking back home, choosing to walk back home. But mainstream television news channel was, you know, showing musical numbers by like Bappi Lahiri or, you know, entertainment stuff catering to a middle-class audience saying that, hey, you stay home and we'll entertain you. So news was kind of working as an entertainer at that time. And then the Tablighi Jamaat incident happened where, you know, that gave a perfect opportunity to flip it into like questions like, you know, kyun ek hi mazhab ke log nahi mante baat or kyun virus phailaya. And you had things like corona bomb or corona jihad and stuff like that being said. And almost for a month, a lot of the focus on reporting on the virus for these television channels was really targeting Tablighi Jamaat. And before that, there was the Shaheen Bagh protest. So because at the beginning, of when the virus just hit us, Shaheen Bagh had not, you know, they were still congregating, even though they were maintaining social distance and all that. So coronavirus first gave an opportunity for TV media to attack them, to say that in the times of pandemic, when we need to social distance, these guys are still sitting on a dharna. So why are these, you know, the idea is to say, why are these Muslims not, you know, budging? And then you had Tablighi Jamaat. So almost for a month or two, you saw
so just to add context to our non-Indian audiences over here, because we have people from the Philippines and South Korea and other parts of Asia listening. The Tablighi Jamaat was essentially an international religious congregation, a largely Muslim congregation that is headquartered
wholly
Muslim congregation, headquartered in Nizamuddin, which is an area of Delhi, which is the capital of India. When that happened, you are saying that this was used as a way to sort of dog whistle and say that Muslims in general are to blame for the spread of the virus. Is that essentially what happened?
Yeah. And the important thing to remember is when this congregation had happened, India had not clamped down on religious congregations. So temples were still open. People were going about even weddings. So there wasn't, it wasn't as if, I mean, of course they flouted some norms and that is, you know, something that has to be reported on, but it wasn't as if there weren't other religious congregations around that time. But this happened and it was used almost for a month or two to specifically, I mean, it went to an extent where anchors almost blamed the Jamaat for the spread of the virus, that corona wouldn't have hit India if it hadn't been for the virus, or that we would have trumped over the virus had it not been for the Tablighis. And Tablighis is a front. So you use that congregation then to ultimately ask questions of why people from a particular religion cannot follow rules, or why people from a particular religion cannot are dogmatic or fundamentalist, or cannot, you know, be civilized enough to maintain social distance or not congregate during the time of the pandemic. So that was essentially how I think they got an opportunity to sort of, and then I think through the pandemic, you know, when the Ram Temple verdict came out, Ayodhya, you didn't have any television channel questioning congregations in Ayodhya, but you did have reports on, say, Eid, that markets are packed and why are people out and why aren't they praying at home? Why do they need to go to a mosque? You know, like Eid and stuff like that, which didn't really happen for festivals.
There were also Hindu religious congregations happening, not one, but multiple throughout the year that were never questioned by mainstream anchors. But this one incident that happened before the lockdown was sort of turned into this dog whistling.
And this is not to say that the Jamaat had not been irresponsible in some of its early in response, but the government allowed that to happen also, because remember, a lot of these were foreign people who had come in. So they did have legitimate visas to come in. They were coming from COVID hotspot area, some of them, but they were allowed to come. And then it turns out that after 7-8 months, the courts actually said that there was no case against the foreign Jamaatis who had come for negligence or for criminal negligence. They were all kind of acquitted. But that wasn't really reported as much as, you know, the congregation was. So what I'm saying is, and the effect that it's had is that if I meet regular people like my neighbors or, you know, maybe relatives, that idea that because of the Tablighi Jamaat, corona spread in India, that was really cemented. So you had a Muslim or a minority community member at the heart of, you know, the reason why a pandemic spread in a country, that was really cemented because these are, again, they are mainstream channels, they have wide reach, especially the Hindi channels. So no matter what the court said eventually about their responsibility, I think the popular perception among people, if you'd ask, if you'd conduct a survey, would be that the Jamaat had a role in spreading coronavirus all over the country, like one of the major roles.
Right.
Which is, I don't think it can be scientifically or proved, or even, I don't think it can be proved even through proper, like, investigative reporting.
I also want to get to the second part of my question, because every time I open the newspaper, the front page has a full page photograph of the Prime Minister, because the government is at least certainly one of the biggest advertisers across all media platforms. And then here comes News Laundry and other digital independent media outlets that they pay to keep the news free. What does that mean?
So News Laundry from the very beginning has been very clear about the fact that we don't want to take advertisements from either governments or corporations, because we are very clear about the fact that if you are going to depend on someone for your money and for your paychecks, you can't be questioning them. So if I am going to take ads from the BJP government or from the Congress government or from any government, I will not be able to honestly report on them or take them to task in a way that's honest and brutal sometimes, because if I do that, my lifeline will be cut. You know, my ads will be stopped. And that's happened to so many Indian magazines and newspapers. The moment they have a story that's critical of the government, the first response of the government is to cut advertisements.
Right.
Similarly for corporations, if you have a story that's negative about a big company, the first reaction is to cut ads. And that's just really the basics. So at News Laundry, we've been very clear about the fact that if we want media, public has to pay. Because if the public is going to pay, journalism is going to serve public. But if BJP or Congress or Tatas or Ambanis are going to pay, we'll have to eventually at some point serve their interests. So that's what really pay to keep news free means, that public has to pay if you want news free media.
And there's this very famous line that says, if you're not paying for something, then you are the product. And that's something exactly that you need to keep in mind with the video. But, you know, what you're saying rationally, it makes a lot of sense. But still, there is an attraction of corporate media. And I think that attraction is this idea of stability, that these models of advertiser-based journalism give stable jobs to journalists, which is why journalists flock to these channels and newspapers. But we've seen in the year of the coronavirus that it's not true. In not just India, but also in Bangladesh. And Badi Usman is here. I want to bring him in as well. And I'm quoting from your article that you came out with in August, Badi Usman. And these are figures from July. I don't have the latest figures. But as of July 2020, 254 newspapers in the city of Dhaka alone were forced to shut down. I don't even know how bad the situation is in rural Bangladesh or in smaller towns in Bangladesh. But this is in Dhaka. 254 newspapers shut down. So let me bring you in, Badi Usman. You wrote an excellent but terrifying article back in August. And I have to say, the headline was very scary. The headline read, "We must save the press before coronavirus sinks it." So again, a two-part question for you. What do these media closures mean for journalists and media freedom in Bangladesh right now? And the second part of my question is, you wrote that article in August, and we are recording this at the end of 2020, one of the worst years that the industry has had. Has it gotten worse or better since August?
First, I would like to say the closures, it didn't happen in Dhaka only. The figure that we have, 252, is from all the 8 divisional cities. It is more than likely many more newspapers and journalists were also closed outside these divisional cities. And one thing you may know, that each district in Bangladesh, often they have local newspapers which doesn't go outside their territory, but it's sold locally. We don't know about that. It is more than likely many more newspapers were also closed. these figure that we have is from the Department of Films and Publications of the government. And of course, it is possible that many more newspapers, even in Dhaka and the other 8 divisional cities, were also closed. But one thing is sure, that no major newspapers were closed. That I can say with some certainty. I don't know much about the district dailies and others. I can only talk about the national dailies. So my guess is, since there is not much research-based knowledge out there, so often it becomes difficult to get real-time information and everything. In Bangladesh, if you talk about press freedom has been in decline long before coronavirus came to our shores. It has been, I have talked at length about how the media access and press freedom suffered in Bangladesh. And during the coronavirus period, starting April, closures are only one part of the problem. There have been retrenchments. There have been various kinds of harassment that, journalists had to face. So all these things together have had a terrible effect on the profession of journalism here in Bangladesh.
And when you talk about, those smaller newspapers getting shut, you're saying that the legacy outlets are still afloat, but the smaller newspapers getting shut, does that mean that there are parts of Bangladesh where information is not coming out, the news is not coming out, and there are these news deserts and these black holes of information getting created?
Well, all the national newspapers have district correspondents. And for example, some of the largest circulating newspapers, Bangla and English, they have divisional bureaus. So even if certain local newspapers get closed, the national dailies are going there. So, and also, of course, many of these platforms have online presence. So even if their print publication, if they discontinue with the print publication, they have online presence. It's not that we are not getting, we are not getting news of what's happening there, because we have the, like I said, the district correspondents and others.
Right. It's interesting that you spoke about, the threats that individual journalists face, not just in terms of closures, because that is also something that Pakistan has been grappling with. And Heather, you've been, in fact, I was just looking at your Twitter timeline before you came on, and you've been constantly amplifying certain threats that journalists have faced. In fact, we got some disturbing news a few weeks ago. 2 digital journalists with a digital news outlet called Voice PK were harassed by Lahore police. This happened in Model Town, which is a pretty cosmopolitan area of Lahore, if I'm not mistaken. So if this is happening in the big cities, I don't even know what's happening. Maybe a lot worse is happening to journalists in other parts of Pakistan. There was one report that said that 138 journalists have been killed in Pakistan in the last 30 years. And now here comes the pandemic, and we have had journalists saying that, look, some areas have become information black holes. It's difficult to get information from certain regions like Khyber Pakhtunkhwa or Balochistan. And journalists covering the anti-polio drive have also faced resistance. So how much has COVID-19 made things worse, or has it made things worse?
So recently, one of the major media outlets, in fact, the oldest newspapers in Pakistan, has started downsizing their desks in Lahore, Islamabad, Peshawar, Karachi. You must have went through it maybe once. Dawn.
Right.
Dawn has started downsizing. They had to let go of their resident editor, Lahore's resident editor. He was a very senior journalist. Similarly, a lot of media channels, either they are being shut down, either they are being pressurized by the government to stop operating in a certain way, giving certain news, or their ads, just like already mentioned, their ads are being taken away. This basically started, although the advertisement issue started in 2018, just when Imran Khan government took over, but now it has just gotten worse. It has gotten so bad that when the mainstream, the journalists working in mainstream media outlets started going towards web TVs or, you know, towards YouTube or social media, the channels issued notices, Shoka's notices, that if you want to work in this particular organization, you cannot have your own YouTube channel or you cannot share news on Twitter. They even stopped journalists from using Twitter. Senior reporters, investigative reporters, because obviously when you're not allowed to give certain kind of news on through your on like your organization, like if you want really are committed to your work, you have to do something about it. And they were basically tweeting everything. If it ever gets banned, if an article, if a story does not get published, they just shared it on Twitter. So this has been going on, and the journalist that you mentioned, Voice PK, basically that's my previous workplace, and they're very good friends of mine, Hamid and Ahmed. Right. Basically, they went to interview the guy who basically provides technical support to all the political gatherings, whether the opposition or the government. So the police came in and he just like messaged in the reporters group that they're here, they're going to get me. I am not even sure that if they're going to take me to the police station or somewhere else, because that's also another major problem. You're not even sure where they're going to take you, if they take you. And then during the pandemic, a lot of journalists had to face defamation cases. And then we have another draconian law, the Electronic Crimes Act in Pakistan. A lot of journalists were targeted through that. Random citizens popping up, they just file complaints that this particular journalist has defamed the country and is apparently working for, like you said, any neighboring country, whatever comes into their mind. Sometimes it's India, sometimes it's, you know, any country.
Same here.
Same here. In fact, Manisha goes through that every week. She
a lot of journalists working for ISI here and a lot of journalists working for RAW in Pakistan. That's
over here, it's so funny because a lot of journalists are apparently working for the ISI, for RAW and CIA and so many others at the same time. But then they don't even have a house of their own. They don't even have proper clothes to wear. And they're apparently working. This is exactly what happened with a very, very senior journalist, Matiullah Jan, recently. He was abducted. He just got lucky because he went to drop his wife at the school where she teaches. And there was CCTV. It captured how the people who were supposed to investigate his abduction came to abduct him. Basically, the police and other law enforcement agencies. And then the video just went viral. He just got lucky.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's so many people who are not lucky, right? Mm-hmm. They lose their jobs. Sometimes they lose their lives. And there's also an impression that, you know, it's always the military or the intelligence which is, you know, behind these abductions or threats or attacks. But it's not just them, right? It's basically everyone you're talking about. It's the politicians, it's the other media outlets. It's
right.
The police, it can be anyone, right? So you don't know where it's coming from. So it has really, really gone, you know, I would say gone crazy. We don't know what's next. You know, we're not even allowed to have our own independent YouTube channels because they've introduced a new law, the new social media rules, which have intensified or increased the penalties on journalists by introducing new rules for not only for the individuals for using the platform, but also for the companies. They're forcing the companies to come into Pakistan, have an office here. So if the rules are applied, the company will be bound to take off the content as told by the regulatory authority. So I don't know. I mean, the channels are already, you know, run by certain officials who just sent a WhatsApp message that you cannot talk about this. You know, you're not allowed to have this particular question.
So since we're running rapidly out of time, let me just put one last question to all of you very quickly, because there are chilling parallels between, you know, all these three countries and the way the media is functioning. So very quickly, if all of you can tell me, what is the one thing that we can learn from each other from the three examples that we've heard about India, Pakistan and Bangladesh? Manisha, if you can go first.
So just on a side note, I wanted to add that I've always felt that journalists in Pakistan especially are really brave, given the circumstances that they're working under. Because the way the state can come after you in Pakistan and how it can really pose a serious, I mean, sometimes even life threat to journalists is not something that happens too much in India. So I think, I mean, we're not there yet at the level at which it is in Pakistan. So I think in Pakistan, journalists who are really reporting on the government, on the agencies, who are being true to their craft are really brave, because they're really battling some serious life-threatening circumstances, I feel. And I, for that reason, have a lot of respect for my colleagues in Pakistan who are, you know, going about reporting and being honest to their craft. I think one thing South Asian journalists can all learn is that all our governments just have a dushmani, you know, an enmity with transparency. They don't treat journalists, you know, you've seen this in so many other countries, that journalists became an important part of the fight against the coronavirus. So journalists were briefed every week, every day on where the country is, how we're fighting it, what is our game plan. You know, I don't know, Pakistan and Bangladesh, my colleagues from there can tell us, but in India, at least, like, journalists who question government on this were almost treated as enemies. You know, are you not with the country? Tum desh ke saath nahi ho jo tum humse sawal pooch rahe ho. So literally, I think the South Asian journalist community can really, I think, from each other learn to stick to their guns and really come together.
Right.
You know, when the government wants to go, it becomes tougher for government to go after many journalists. It's easier to go after one journalist who's questioning. But if all journalists come together and ask questions that are relevant to
people, you can't go after the collective in the same sort of way.
It's tougher to come out against them. And I think all of us can learn so much about resilience. And I really hope there are more platforms for us to interact with each other, because we all have similar experiences on many occasions. So
true.
I think just unionizing and coming together, you know, to report on what's in public interest, that's something that we all can learn from each other and carry about our work despite intense threats. There's so much inspiration from journalists from South Asia who've really fought a tyrannical government or tyrannical agencies.
That's true.
And hostile environments to report.
Very quickly, because we're running out of time. Badi Usman, what's the one thing that you think that the journalists from all these three countries can learn from each other?
Well, I can relate to what Haider said in terms of harassment facing journalists. But also, I mean, as I went through some figures earlier today, the RSF just released some figures. And I saw that in India, there were 4 deaths last year. And compared to that, I wouldn't say in Bangladesh, there was only one journalist. And that was perhaps 2 months ago. But these figures do not shed much light on the kind of harassment that we have and the fear and everything that we have to go through.
Right.
But I will agree with Manisha that the kind of resilience that we witnessed, although there has been restrictions on movement and journalists couldn't visit as often as they did last year, but still the kind of resilience, the kind of threats they faced and the, you know, and the way they reacted, many, you know, when going out of their way to report and everything. I think it's really inspiring to see all these examples. And I know even some of my colleagues, how they face various kinds of threats and they still came out more determined than ever. This is really inspiring. And these stories that I hear from Haider and Manisha,
absolutely.
It's really inspiring.
Heather, I'll let you have the last word. The words of Indian poet Amir Aziz, Sab Yaad Rakha Jayega, has become a hashtag in Pakistan. What can you learn from India and Bangladesh?
We are pretty much in the similar situation. We're facing, all of us are facing pretty much the similar kind of challenges. And I'd like to second what Manisha said and what Badi Usman said. And I just believe that the only solution to get past this situation is to do what we have been doing more aggressively. Because if we back out or if we give up, it's just going to get worse. And if we really want to live the kind of lives that we really want to live, and since what we're trying to do is for the people, and I'd just like to end it with the answer to, you know, bad democracy or bad press freedom is more press freedom and more democracy, right? That's the only solution. You know, we just have to do our work more aggressively. We stop now, or, you know, start thinking about the consequences. Of course, there are things to think about, but then we must keep doing it. That's the only solution.
Right.
Push the people back.
Right. This is an
absolutely. I just want to add just one thing on Bangladesh that I think in 2020, reporting on elections, what amazing courage journalists showed there. I mean, they were harassed, beaten, denied access to credible information, to polling booths, and they went and still, you know, did their job. So that was really, really inspiring to see, you know, journalists be at it.
Absolutely. I really wish we had more time. Absolutely riveting discussion. Remember, if the media is free, then all of us are free. Thank you so much to Manisha, Badi Usman and Heather for joining me for this very special podcast for the Asia Democracy Network. Thank you so much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you, Uday.
Thank you all. It was really nice chatting with all of you.
Yeah.